Well, hello, friends. Welcome to the All Terrain Podcast. I usually record this intro around the fire in my backyard, but today I'm on the waterfront in Baltimore near the Admiral Fell Inn. Not every trip can be on country roads, unfortunately. A quick reminder to check the show notes on allterrainpodcast.com for more information about the things discussed in this and every episode. And you may as well check out the store while you're there if you like stickers, patches, and hats. Today, we're talking to Dan Strait, a local Reno overlander, backcountry gourmet, fly fisherman, hiker, and amateur barista with a passion for making high-quality espresso in the backcountry. You can find Dan on Instagram and follow his culinary exploits at home and afield at Strait8. That's at Streight and the number 8. Dan was sent to us by our friend Harry Wagner, who you met in episode 1 of this show. Know someone we should talk to? Hit me up on the website and let me know. All right, here's episode 6 with Dan Strait.
And I was told the ringleader, if you will, was very fastidious. Out the door at 6 a.m., we're hiking trails, you know, going fly fishing. And there wasn't really any time for espresso. But at that time, I had an espresso, you know, manual machine, and I took it with me. And the first morning, it was like, you know, we don't have time for this. And I'm like, come on, John, it's not going to take me that long. And I made him espresso. You know what? For the next 10 days, we always had time for espresso. Yeah.
You see your car come all the way off the ground?
So, Dan, thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so just straighten that out. So you came recommended from Harry Wagner, who you may remember from episode number 1.
Yes.
So tell me what's your background? What do you do? Why do you drive around in the backcountry?
Well, it's sort of an addiction. It's, I hate to use that term, but it's my church.
Right. Yep.
Grew up, had parents that took us out camping and fishing and hunting from, gosh, as far back as I can remember.
Right.
So dirt's under my skin.
Dirt's under your skin. Yeah.
So we just, you know, I've done it in a variety of different, modes or vehicles.
Right.
And the last 12 to 13 years I've been in a Toyota Land Cruiser.
Okay. Which series?
It's a UZJ100. So that's the 100 series. It's a 1999.
Right.
So it's the first series with independent front suspension.
Yeah. Is that pretty nice?
It is. It's very comfortable, but, you know, it's complex. So
right.
It wasn't as easy to modify as some of the
right.
prior series Land Cruisers.
Yeah. Those are pretty bolt-on stuff.
Yeah,
right?
But it's comfortable. It's capable for
right.
what it is. And
right.
Yeah, it's been a good vehicle.
So what did you've lifted it a little bit?
Lifted. I've got a 1-inch body lift. One of the things that's important on that particular platform is to preserve the constant velocity joint angles. And
right.
through trial and error, right. you know, I started out lifting it 3 or 4 inches. And
right.
the problem with that is durability, reliability relative to the front drive system
right.
goes south in a hurry.
Yeah.
So
I noticed that too on the
learned,
forerunner.
Yeah. Lowering the suspension, but raising the body 1 inch has allowed me to run 305 width tires,
okay.
35 inch without any rubbing.
Huh.
So,
but stock suspension height or just?
It's about 1 inch taller than stock suspension
okay.
height, but not enough to get into reliability issues or durability issues with the front
right.
axle system. And basically, I don't have any torque steer. That's the other uh-huh. compromise. The farther you lift those control arms on the
right.
front IFS, the more torque steer can be induced. So
tell me what that means real quick. I think I know, but.
Okay. Well, a torque steer is when you accelerate, you know, when you get your foot into the pedal, wide open throttle, WOT as it's called.
Right.
You can actually induce some auto steer in the front drive system. So it tends to want to pull typically to the right.
Okay.
So you have to counter that with the steering wheel
right.
pulling left. So it's not neutral.
Right.
Whereas typically a solid front axle. Like the 80 series, 60 series, et cetera, have, there's really no torque steer induced
mm-hmm.
to it, but it's a part of the design of, you know, it's part of what can be induced in a negative trait relative to IFS, independent front suspension.
Interesting. So before you got into the
were you more into like ever into rock crawling, four wheeling, that sort of thing?
No, the rock crawling thing never really appealed to me. Going back in another chapter of my life, I was big time bicyclist, mountain biker. Okay. I rode trials, observed trials competitively.
Maybe that's why your name sounds familiar.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Toured on bikes, backpacker, fly fisherman, all cool. those things. And the Land Cruiser kind of brings it all together.
Where are you from, Reno?
Originally from Omaha, Nebraska. Okay. Moved here in 1996. And, you know, it's an outdoors person's paradise.
It is, yeah.
It's the best kept secret in the lower 48.
And what do you do to pay the bills?
I'm retired right now.
What did you do to pay the bills?
I was in, the first chapter of my life, I was in the bicycle business in Omaha. It was good to me. And wanted to be closer to the mountains.
Right.
An opportunity came about in Reno, in the bicycle business, in that space. But didn't work out. And of all things, I ended up in the copier business.
Okay.
So I retired from there in, 2009.
Oh, that's good.
Had a couple little part-time gigs since then. But for the most part, I'm retired.
Cool. Awesome. Well, it's more time for adventure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the questions.
Okay.
So you and listeners know this, and I'll tell Dan that we do the same questions for everybody, and these questions are kind of the common questions that pop up on the forums and the Facebooks and the social media and stuff. I would say people just getting into overlanding as a thing will ask these questions. And for people like yourself who have been doing this for forever, it's going to sound obvious, but it certainly is something that you've thought about over the years. So first off, we'll start with the easy question, which is who's in your overland crew? Who do you go out with? Who do you adventure with?
Typically I like to travel in smaller groups. So at the most, six rigs. As you know, or most know, if you've been out, even whether it's backpacking or cycling, the greater the number of participants, the greater logistics, the more compromise you have, and just not as enjoyable for me. So
right.
I've got some Land Cruiser friends that we travel with. Kind of even moving into another space, my soon-to-be wife and I want to basically live as a combination RV parks and boondocking. That's
right.
Kind of another term.
I know that's a new term too. With
it comes from the RV world. They don't know overlanding, so they call it boondocking.
Okay.
But so primarily it'll just be us two.
Cool.
For the most part.
Awesome. Six, you say small group, six is that's a big group by my standards. We'll do two or three.
Yeah, two or three is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You're only typically in the backcountry where dust is an issue, typically the trucks are separated maybe, a mile or two.
Right.
So six vehicles, you could be spread out over 10 or 12
miles. A long
way,
yeah.
So it's just more work. It's more work for the lead person, and it's more work for the tail gunner.
Right.
Keep the group together, keep everyone safe. If someone breaks down, the logistics of...
Yeah, regrouping from a big group like that would take a while.
But there's much more freedom with smaller groups.
Yeah. All right. So we talked about your overlanding vehicle. You've got the 100 series, Land Cruiser. Can you just tell me a little bit why you chose that vehicle?
I went back Toyota's renowned for its reliability.
Yeah.
And I don't want to cast a shadow on Land Rovers, but I actually investigated that for about a year and decided that Toyota reliability is where I wanted to be.
Right.
Something about Japanese, they're not the best inventors in the world, but they'll take an idea and refine it till it's near perfection.
Yeah,
and
great.
I think Toyota's done a really good job with the Land Cruiser series over the years with that.
Okay.
And then it came down to a matter of choosing between an 80 series, a little smaller, straight six-cylinder, but solid front axle, and I decided that I wanted the higher horsepower or output of the V8.
Right.
I think if I had to do that decision again, I might not have slanted that way, because it's the 100 series. It is so much more complex and so much more limiting in terms of lift and overall capability in the backcountry. So,
how does the front suspension on a 99 100 series compare to like a 4Runner?
Very similar design. The Land Cruiser components in terms of axles, differential, Control arms are much larger diameter. Mm-hmm. So there's
pushing more power through it.
Exactly. But overall design is very similar to a 4Runner.
And is it a whole different than, because at that time they didn't have the Tundra, they had like the T100.
Correct.
Is it similar? Like, is it all its own parts?
I'm not intimately familiar with the T100. They both share the 2UZ FE, which is the 4.7 liter V8 engine.
Right.
I believe the front suspension system, the IFS, independent front suspension, is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But the Land Cruiser is, if you compare visually the parts difference between particularly a 4Runner and Land Cruiser, everything looks like it's about 50% larger.
Really?
Just heavier duty.
Interesting.
And you know, the vehicle's a little bit heavier, too.
Yeah.
The 4Runner is an incredibly capable vehicle.
Yeah.
In its own right.
It's surprising, too. You know, I've only been on an IFS vehicle like that for a couple of years. But it's not really holding us back, you know, and particularly for overlanding where you spend a lot of time blazing down dirt roads, it's pretty nice.
Yeah. Oh, it's far more comfortable. There's no question. So majority, in fact, I'm really the only 100 series in our little group of guys. Everyone else is an 80 series.
Right.
And, you know, on a long stretch of washboard, you know, an 80 series can't really keep up.
Mm.
But the more technical the train, the harder I have to work as a driver to overcome you know, the downsides.
Do you have any like aftermarket locker stuff in it, or does it come with all that?
Yeah, we re-geared it. So we went from the stock 430 ring and pinion ratio to 488s.
Okay.
I put an ARB front locker. It came with the factory Toyota e-locker in the back, and that's been reliable.
Those are pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So how do you carry your gear in that thing? Do you have it all decked out with roof racks and the overlanding stuff?
Yeah, we have an Autohome Columbus variant on top.
Okay.
So it's a rooftop tent.
Right. Is that the rigid ones?
It's a fiberglass full length, so it's non-folding. It's very quick to deploy.
Right.
Literally 10 to 15 seconds and you're up in it and maybe a minute or two to get it taken down.
Cool.
Remove the second and third row seats. So
right
in the back, I've got a drawer system.
Okay.
12 volt fridge freeze. Top that, and in the middle, I don't have the seats. I've had a friend of mine manufacture fabricate out of stainless steel a near 20 gallon water tank.
Oh wow!
And atop that sit three large plastic dustproof containers that get strapped down.
Okay.
As you know, or probably know, you know, in the backcountry, things can move around.
Yes,
so
they
it's
do.
Vital for safety
to
keep everything, you know, well anchored. So
cool.
But all this came about, you know, it's driven by application. I didn't know what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
We just started, you know, starting going off road, and we started modifying as we went along. And I think that's probably it certainly can be the longest process.
For sure.
But in the end, you really get what you need, and you don't end up spending on things you don't need.
Right. And who built that tank for you?
It's a good friend of mine that's in the commercial fabrication space here in Reno.
Okay.
He used to work at Fabtech. He's now retired, but he did a lot of work for me. I've had various trailers and always seem to want to modify them. And, I don't have sheet metal bending capabilities. I'm a welder and I do that type of work, but there's just some things I can't fabricate in my garage.
It's, you know, it's funny. I've been building some stuff for my 4Runner to make things more organized, and it's fun to do. And, but I find myself not wanting to commit to cutting metal for something if I'm not 100% sure that it's going to work, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, but at the same time, there's so many fabricators in Reno and Carson City that do this kind of work. I wonder if it's like that everywhere you go, or if it's Reno special.
Well, the bigger cities, Denver's a hotbed of you know, off-road vehicle fabricators, Las Vegas, Southern California, certainly, Phoenix area. But it's, you know, last 20 years has seen a phenomenal growth in the space of what we now call overlanding.
Mm-hmm.
Not only in the Toyota world, certainly, but Land Rovers and, gosh, the sky's the limit.
For sure. So I think we answered the how do you sleep question, or where do you sleep question, but so tell us a little bit more about the Autohome Columbus rooftop tent that you use. It's fast to deploy. How is it comfortable to sleep in?
It's very comfortable. And again, if you have some experience with rooftop tents, most of them, the mattress is not very comfortable.
Right, so it's just foam.
Typically, that's the first thing that goes. So I've done a kind of a dual density system of my own. Went over to Millland Fabric, brought some foam, and for the most part, it works really well.
Cool. Yeah, Millland Fabric is a local fabric store in Reno that has the first section of the store is just all foam, egg crate foam, high density foam. You can take Pelican cases and have them custom cut foam for your cameras and stuff. So it's a really nice place to get that stuff.
Yeah. I put, big LED strip in it with a rheostat, so I can dim it down. It's not Hilton comfortable, but it's backcountry comfortable.
It's good enough, yeah. And it's pretty good in the wind and the rain.
Yes, exactly. When we're traveling down the trail or road, it's the Autohome Columbus being fiberglass. It's a very aerodynamic shape,
right?
So we haven't really seen a big hit. Actually, maybe half a mile per gallon.
Right.
It's pretty slippery. Going down the road, very little wind drag. So and not much noise.
Yeah, and when it's set up, it seems pretty stable too.
It is, I think there's still some refinement that can be done in that whole category of rooftop tents. Mm-hmm. The biggest compromise when winds, hint hint, we never see winds more than 15 miles an hour in the backcountry, right?
Right. Yeah.
But the fabric can get a little noisy in some of those big wind events. But that's really been our only complaint about it. And that's a similar complaint regardless of brand, it seems like.
Well, in a ground tent, it's going to be windy too, or it's going to flap.
Same thing, yeah.
Although it's that much closer to the ground, you'd assume the wind is lower.
Yeah, and that's one of the many advantages of a rooftop tent, is that regardless of how rocky or sage-covered the ground or whatever the ground is, you can be sleeping in a very flat, comfortable surface without having to find that ideal tent site.
Right. And do you how hard is it? Can it be hard to level the vehicle so that you can find a levelish place to sleep?
Normally it isn't. And it seems like wherever we go, there's either, logs or rocks. And typically it's 5 to 10 minutes and the truck is leveled off pretty easily.
Cool. Cool. So what's your food of choice? Home cooking, backpacker food, Snickers bars?
Well, we have a problem.
Oh, yeah?
We like to eat well in the backcountry.
Right.
So, and fortunately, with the folks I travel with, we all come from the same affliction. So we do some pretty exotic. In fact, some of the people that join us that have not experienced our group, the comment is, you guys eat better on the trail than we eat at home.
Right. I believe that.
So, we can get, but probably the last couple of years have kind of gone back to a little bit simpler.
Right.
So we're just not spending hours cooking. One of the things we enjoy is we'll make burritos at home, wrap them in foil, and then freeze them. And then on these, 2-week trips, pull a couple burritos out, put them on the radiator in the morning, and then by lunch, they're hot and gooey, and it's a very simple midday meal. Yeah, it works really well.
So when you guys go full gourmet, what do you end up cooking with? What kind of cooking stove, whatnot?
Well, I've got a couple of different stoves, but primarily I'm using a Partner Steel cook stove, relatively lightweight. Pretty stingy on propane. A lot of my other guys are in the Coleman world, white gas, very, very high BTU for the amount of fuel space.
Like the old pump stoves.
Yeah, and they're very serviceable in the backcountry if something goes wrong. And you can pick them up at garage sales for 20, 40 bucks.
Yeah, I used to have one. I mean, I think I sold one at a garage sale.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were going to come back into style.
So we've done, we carry a couple of those little collapsible Coleman ovens. So we bake cookies. Yep. We've done souffles.
Right.
Steaks, duck breasts.
Wow.
It's pretty crazy.
I guess you run a fridge, like you said, and what kind of fridge do you have?
I have a Waco. Okay. It's a 50-liter fridge freeze. It's done very well. It's over 12 years old.
And oh, wow.
Just keeps on working. It was one of those things. That was one of the first accessories, I wanted to get. I was tired of waterlogged sandwiches, you know, the dealing with ice, where to find ice on a longer backcountry trip. And, you know, all those fridge freezers, you know, they're over $500. Some of them are $2,000. And that was one of the big stumbling blocks I had. Because you can go down to Home Depot, right? But for less than you would pay for a very small 12-volt fridge freeze, you can buy something that, you know, hold multiples of that.
Right.
And my buddy Andy over in Sacramento said, well, let me know how that works out for you.
Right.
But, you know, once you get over the price of those things, the payback in terms of convenience and capability is just almost immeasurable.
Right. I agree. Yeah. I mean, we're still using coolers, but I definitely, it's on my list of things to get next to the proper fridge.
And the side benefit, if you entertain at home or at the holiday time, you plug it into, you know, 110 volt and it becomes, overflow for, you know, whatever you want to use around the house. So it has other applications as well.
The thing that I see most beneficial of a fridge like that for my application would be being able to load it on Thursday for a trip on Friday.
Yeah,
you know,
that is
just
a nice
get
feature.
It all set and done. So it takes one, because you know what, with a family, we got getting out the door is a challenge.
Yeah, right.
And so one less thing to throw in the car would make it a lot
nicer.
And
that's a nice feature. And trips to Trader Joe's for all their wonderful frozen food.
Yeah.
You know, it's 100 degrees outside.
Yeah.
Take the
Don't have to go straight home.
Yeah, exactly. It's all stays frozen.
Nice. Okay. So here's the question everybody loves. Where do you poop? What do you do for toiletries in the backcountry?
There's a little bit of a backstory there.
Okay.
The group that I travel with, they're informally called these days NorCal 80s.
Okay.
So it's a bunch of guys from California, typically a few guys from northern Nevada.
Right.
But one of the things was we need to be conscious of litter. Everything we take in, we pull out in regards to litter, trash, cans, bags. Most of us, if not all, have bags that hang off the spare tire.
Right, the trasheroo.
Trasheroo or something similar. Inevitably, we end up cleaning up after others if we have space. But the other part about that is taking out our human waste.
Mm-hmm.
When there's only a few people in the backcountry, they'll dig in a pit, and using that to poop in isn't a big environmental concern as long as it's done properly.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, now we have thousands of people doing this,
right.
So it becomes
right.
a much larger issue. So cut to the quick, we use WAG bags. That's one brand.
Right.
Basically, poop in a bag, seal it up, and you know they typically have a chemical that renders the solid waste into a gel-like substance that can go right into landfill.
Okay, and so you throw those in the trasheroo and you're good to go.
Exactly.
Huh.
Yeah, that's pretty sticky about that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, six vehicles, you're talking 12 or more or people, and that's. You know, that's a lot of pooping to be done at one campsite.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that, and, you know, our dream is that we wish this technology and the motivation to use those WAG bags would cross beyond the overlanding group.
Mm-hmm.
I go to some beautifully pristine, or what should be pristine, locations, you know, in the West, California, Nevada, these high-altitude lakes for fly fishing, and we're always amazed at the signs of human waste, toilet paper.
Just leave the toilet paper right there.
Yeah, exactly. It's depressing.
It's horrifying. I wish they would use it in like rock climbing. A lot of the places, you know, semi, like if you go up to the base of Half Dome or something, there's a toilet area.
Wow.
And, you know, like used to be different. I think it is different now. I think people are using stuff like that now, but in the past, you know, the toileting situation and climbing in Yosemite was not awesome.
Yeah. Well, and that exists within the backpacking or more mountain, like I said, mountain climbing. I know Shasta has a reputation at the top base camp.
Well, Shasta, you're supposed to pack it out too there. And to get a permit, they have these sheets of papers, like 11 by 17 paper, and you go on that. There's a target.
Oh.
And then you fold it up and double bag it.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that. Wow.
Yeah. It's not WAG bags. Well, it may be WAG bags now. I haven't done it in like 10 years. But 10 years ago, they give you these kits, and you have to use those. It was like a blue bag or something, a blue sheet or something like that. Because, you know, it's on snow. There's nowhere for it to go.
Right.
It's not going to decompose. It's just going to freeze there and melt out someday.
So the excuses, you know, when we're in motor vehicles that have phenomenal storage capability, the excuse to do this is just falls out the window.
Right.
You know, when it's on your back, that's one thing. But, you know, you've got a 3-ton truck with tons of storage space inside and outside, and there's just very little excuse for it.
Yeah, you know, the I really need to get one of those Trasheroos for my setup. I don't have a tire, so I got to come up with a creative solution and mount a Trasheroo just to the hatch somehow.
Right.
So yeah, that's my list of things to do.
Yeah, you might. You're familiar with Expedition Portal?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a good resource.
Maybe there's somebody there. That's
maybe
done
somebody
that
has an idea. We're shifting gears right now. We're in the process of bought a 2007 Chevy HD 2500 Duramax pickup.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I'll have a rear bumper built instead of storing the tire underneath. It's going to be on a swing arm, which is not, it's very typical in the Land Rover Land Cruiser world.
Right.
Somewhat atypical in the, you know, the American pickup truck world, but it serves a lot of applications. And one is being able to store that trash, all sorts of trash on the outside of the vehicle.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, we heard about rag bags in one of the previous episodes, but it's building the case, at least in my mind, for using those more often, particularly in places that are more highly impacted, like Death Valley and Mojave Road in particular.
Definitely.
So what kind of recovery gear do you carry and what do you think is most important to have in that regard?
Well, education about recovery is probably the most important. You could have all the gear in the world, and winches can be lethal items if they're not used properly. So I consider education as the number one thing to have on board. There are a number of professional services that you can go learn how to safely recover a vehicle.
Right.
Bill Burke has made a career of that. He has DVDs. That's where I started.
Okay.
A shovel is very important, and a jack system, whether it's the original equipment jack. You know, at some point, you're going to need to either change a tire or you're going to need to jack or raise the vehicle to get out of the mud, whatever. So I happen to have a winch on the front of my vehicle. I've used it a lot.
Right.
We try not to get stuck, but it happens.
Right.
So knowing how to use it is paramount. Having the right equipment, making sure the equipment is within its rated capacity or use application is
and
important.
Not trashed, but frayed.
I highly recommend Bill Burke's. His first DVD was called Getting Unstuck. Mm-hmm. It's like a $25 investment. Probably the best thing you could do for yourself if you're just starting out. And even old timers, it's amazing. Some of the people that have traveled the backcountry for decades. And when it comes time to extricate their vehicle, it's amazing there aren't more people seriously maimed or killed because they don't know how to use this equipment.
Right, for sure. You know, and one thing in that regard is people are inherently bad at estimating risk of things. And then also you look back in your mind and you think that, I used my winch and everything was fine. And so you think that outcomes are binary. It's either success or failure.
Right.
But there's a third outcome, which is a near miss.
Yeah.
You know, like something went wrong, but nobody got hurt. That's not considered a failure. So I think people need to look back on their own experience and understand where things could have gone wrong, but didn't, and take action before it does go wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about tools and spare parts? Are you pretty cautious in that regard?
Well, one of the advantages of going with people that have the same platform, the same rig, is there's some cross-pollination, if you will, of carrying parts. So everyone doesn't have to carry a spare drive shaft or everyone doesn't have to carry a spare axle. But the more remote the country you're in, the more parts you have to carry.
Right.
I've actually had to fix my vehicle in backcountry Utah. There's no way to get a vehicle out.
Right.
So if you can't fix it, including onboard welders, grinders, all of that, it's going to be very, very expensive, if not impossible, to remove a vehicle that is otherwise, you know, incapacitated. So it's
there for the duration, huh?
But I carry a wide range of parts. It's it's almost impossible to carry everything you need. But one of the things about being very familiar with the platform is you tend to get an idea of the things that are that need to be carried. Like in my vehicle, carrying front drive axle parts, carrying a CV axle. Right. I've had to do that in the backcountry.
Yeah. Are they the same on both sides in that vehicle?
They happen to be on the 100 series. And then being familiar with how to fix things, right? So if you have the parts, but you don't know how to install them, that's just as bad as not having
it. Toyotas are pretty easy to work on generally.
Yeah,
except for changing the oil.
Yeah, and just preventative maintenance. The things that I do are an accelerated preventative maintenance cycle than somebody just traveling again the highway.
Right. Yeah, you don't want ball joints failing in the backcountry.
Yeah.
Or drive axles.
Yeah, you know the old saying, an ounce of prevention.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. So what do you guys do for hygiene? Are you an onboard shower guy or a lake?
Onboard shower. We've gotten spoiled. Yeah. I've got a little kit I put together. I've got a Helton hot water heat exchanger on the engine, so it's relatively easy and quick. At the end of the day, the engine's hot, so we can use the latent heat to heat water, take a quick shower.
When the engine's off?
When you turn your engine off, the coolant's still sitting there at near 200 degrees. So rather than just have that escape to the environment, you can use that heat exchanger to heat water up for a very nice shower. You can, if you have proper setup with water efficiency in mind, you can take a very nice shower with a gallon of water.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So we've gotten spoiled with that.
Yeah. It's nice in some cases, like you're talking about heat and sweat and dust and sunblock and all that stuff adds up to make you pretty uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just nice. It's nice to have that. We don't use it every day, but.
So you said
it's a luxury.
Is it a heat exchanger that you made or that you bought?
I bought. And the company is from Australia. It's called Helton.
Helton.
They have hot water heaters, shower heaters. There are a number of USA plate style. If you just Google onboard heat exchangers, there's a plethora of choices out there.
So does this one tee into the coolant system?
Exactly. So I tee off my heater lines, and basically it's a copper can with a double wrap copper coil. So the fresh water goes through the copper coil, and the coolant surrounds that coil. Mm-hmm. So as the coolant is, 185, 200 degrees, the copper allows the exchange of that heat to heat that cold water.
Pretty quickly,
Yeah, it really is. It's and I've got a little 12-volt pump.
It's a
nice system.
It sounds nice, yeah. I mean, we don't have that set up, and every once in a while we'll hose the kids off in the shower on the side of my parents' four-wheel camper.
Yeah.
That's handy to have sometimes. What do you use for communication? What kind of radios?
I have a ham license.
Okay.
So a tech license. Again, like most, started off in the CB world and learned the inefficiency or lack of capability in the backcountry. You have about a mile.
Yeah.
With
And proper, it takes up a lot of space in your vehicle, too.
That, too. With ham equipment, we've done point to point out to 80 miles. It's not the norm, but the capability and for the little bit of time it takes to pass a test and get a license for the decade, the licenses are good for a decade.
Yeah, so. For a long time. And it's inexpensive. Well, until you start buying gear.
Yeah. Well, then today, you can get set up for less than $100.
Yeah, so. That's true.
The cost thing is a poor excuse these days.
It is.
10 years ago when I started out, it was a much, much bigger investment.
Are you running a handheld or a unit in the vehicle?
I have both. I have a Kenwood 710A inside. So it's a dual band. So I have one band set up for APRS. For instance, if we were camping and you wanted to join our group and we were both on APRS, you could see my vehicle location on your display. So it makes it very easy, like at night. To find us, or vice versa.
And the APRS, that works vehicle to vehicle as well as through the network, right?
That is correct. Okay. You can use it linked in from an APRS repeater, or it works direct peer-to-peer from ham radio.
And that's automatic, right?
Correct.
You don't have to,
Yep.
Yeah, so that's the unit that I want to replace my CB with for that very reason. Although I need to get my crew up on the get their ham license so we can actually use it. But it seems really valuable. So have you used the APRS setup? Like, to what effect do you use it on your trips?
Well, in real terms, you know, there's just a couple of us that use it. Mm-hmm. Even within the licensed ham operators, there's been a little bit of a reluctance to go out and buy yet another
right.
ham radio. It was something I was interested in learning. The practical right. application, you know, again, I've come into these groups at night. No one in the group's using APRS, so I have to do old school, get somebody out right. of the tent at 11 o'clock and have them walk me in. You know, right. sometimes it's in terrain you're unfamiliar with at night. You don't know where in the heck
right.
you're going.
Right.
But so, you know, it takes a commitment a part of the group, just like the ham radio itself. We right. all came from CB,
mm-hmm.
and there was this motivation. And, you know, once you get two or three members in the group and you're talking, you know, if mm-hmm. you're out on an event, you've got six people, two or three are on ham radio, I can guarantee you within that next 6 to 12 months, the people that
right.
weren't a part of the conversation on the trail will have their yeah. ham licenses.
It works. So. It works so well.
Yeah.
It's really nice. What's your call sign?
K7NCM.
K7NCM. Cool. What do you use for navigation?
I've used a variety of systems over the years. I've had PC tablets, I've had laptops, for the last 10 plus years, I've relied on a Lowrance 540C. It's called a Baja 540C. Mm-hmm. It's a little old school today, but it doesn't overheat. I can nav on the fly. All of the systems, you know, the iPad systems, the Android tablet systems, everything, just like vehicles, right? Everything has a pro column
right.
and a con column.
Right.
The problem with a lot of these laptops or tablets,
yeah.
They can't handle heat very well. I've had my iPad shut down, you know, it's sitting on the dash.
Right, because it's the heat.
Yeah, it just gets overheated. Yeah. You can't really navigate on the fly. So you have to decide, you know, what's most important. The other thing right. I liked about the Lowrance is I can have all of the United States, you know, 24,001
mm-hmm.
scale topo maps on a card, where a lot of these software-driven applications for iPad and other tablets, you have to go in and download tiles
right.
for the area you're going to be
right.
in. And if you're not going to be beyond the borders of those tiles, you're fine. But what happens if you're out for a little bit longer and
yep.
somebody says, we want to go here,
yep.
and now you don't have those tiles? So that's been the drawback for me, embracing some of that newer iPad, if you will.
Yeah. Having those every map available, it would be really nice. I can see for a lot of those cases.
Yeah. And if you, not that what we do is similar to Baja 500, Baja 1000, but if you look at the off-road race circuit, they're still utilizing those Lowrance devices.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that they're all using that's one of the more popular
yeah.
choices for that, yeah. that setup. All right. Well, we're getting close to the end here. What non-driving activities do you like to do on your trips these days?
Primarily it's hiking. So it's fun to get into an area and then hike mm-hmm. trails or overlanding from there. Fly fishing is another big love of mine. So
okay.
It really dovetails well into having this platform to be able to access this more remote country
right.
and either hike to streams or lakes for fly fishing or you know, possibly just camp and
right.
use a float tube.
Yeah. Well, a good four-wheel drive and an awesome dirt road will get you to a lot of places where you can hike to some place pretty spectacular to go fishing.
Right, right. And good food.
Yeah.
And a shower.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah, espresso.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So I think Harry wanted me to ask you about the coffee situation.
Yeah, I'm a little crazy.
Tell
about
me about
that.
The coffee situation.
Well, I've been into espresso for 30 years, been making it at home for
right.
over two decades. And there's a number of little devices you can get to make a true espresso in the backcountry, mm-hmm. and I do that, and everybody gives me my share of BS.
Right. No, you won't get it from me.
Until we stop and I crank out a half a dozen espressos, and then all that goes away.
Yeah.
So, but it, you know, it's one of my little little hobbies.
So what do you use?
Well, I've got a, there's a gentleman that started out, he couldn't buy what he wanted. So he made these, it's called Espresso Forge. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he has 20 or 40 units built and he sells them. And 6 months goes by and he accumulates some orders. So it's very homegrown, Espresso stainless Forge, steel. Huh? It's bulletproof. Your kids' kids will use it.
So what is it? Is it like a Moka pot kind of a thing?
No, it's actually basically a stainless steel tube with a plunger.
Okay.
And you pour hot water in it, and it has a regular porter filter ring, and you get true espresso. I have one at
home.
You
push it yourself? You push it with muscle power?
Yeah, it's got a tripod, and you push down on it.
Okay.
If you Google Espresso Forge, there's some other devices as this similar to the overlanding hobby. Espresso is... the last 10 years has really grown. So there are a number of different portable devices that you can get true espresso wherever you're at.
Right. And so the true espresso means it applies to the grind size and then the pressure used to extract it.
Yes. So typically espresso, a number of definitions, but basically you're extracting under 9 bar of pressure thereabouts, and that's about 135 pounds of pressure. So... yeah, again, it's different than coffee. It's more complex than coffee.
Right.
So it's definitely something that takes, it's a labor of love.
It is. Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I have, the machine that I showed you when you came in is a one touch, a Seiko one touch. And it's good enough for how easy it is. The other thing we have here at the collective is Moka pots, which are good for what they are.
Yeah,
it's a different kind of a thing.
Very simple.
And then one thing I got at home, I haven't taken it camping yet, but is the AeroPress.
Right.
Which is really good for how easy it is.
Very simple.
And I know there are hacks, and I think they just call them hacks for the Moka press, where you can make a lever actuated plunger system to get it up near 9
bars.
Seen those. It's Lexan, so you're probably approaching the limits of its structural integrity when you hit 9 bars, but it's getting close.
And we've got a little off-road trailer, and I've set it up with a lithium iron phosphate battery, 200 amp. And I actually take, it's called an Olympia Express Cremina. So it has a 1,000-watt boiler. But again, it's a little overkill until you've had a wonderful true cappuccino in the morning or two or three.
Yeah. Or two or three. Yeah,
it's funny. Sure. We got invited on Alaska fishing trip, and one of the things was I was coming into a group of 4 guys, and I was told the ringleader, if you will, was very fastidious. Out the door at 6 a.m., we're hiking trails, and we're going fly fishing.
Right.
And there wasn't really any time for espresso. But at that time, I had a espresso, manual machine, and I took it with me. And the first morning, it was like, we don't have time for this. And I'm like, come on, John. It's not going to take me that really long. And I made him an espresso. You know what? For the next 10 days, we always had time for espresso.
His tune.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right. Well, we're here at the end, and I usually have something clever to say at the end, but I don't this time because I didn't have time. But thank you, Dan, for joining us. And it was really cool hearing about your perspective on pooping and coffee.
Yeah. Right on, Mike.
Which go together like peanut butter and jelly, right?
Yeah, right on. There you go.
All right, thanks. Well, we're out, and thanks for watching on YouTube, and thanks for listening on the podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Cheers.
If you have questions or comments for me or my guests, please post a comment on the show notes on our website, allterrainpodcast.com, where you'll find any links mentioned to this show, as well as videos, trip reports, and more. You can also find us on Instagram at All Terrain Podcast. All Terrain Podcast was created, produced, engineered, and edited by me, Mike Henderson. Special thanks to Chris Webster of the Archaeology Podcast Network and Colin Loretz of the Overwatch Hero Show. The podcast is recorded at Reno Collective, a co-working community in Reno, Nevada. Learn more at renocollective.com.